You're listening to KBOO in Portland, 90.7 FM. K220HR in White Salmon, Washington, and K264AA in Corvallis. Stay tuned for the KBOO Morning News. This program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, introducing Pete's E-Cups, letting you send a warm gesture that says a lot on the web at Pete's.com. That's P-E-E-T-S.
Good morning, it's Wednesday, December 14th, 2005, and this is the KBOO Morning News. I'm Carlos Chavez.
And I'm Brian Smith.
The cost of rental housing has increased faster than wages, making it more difficult for low-income families to find housing. The Pentagon is drafting a request for up to $100 billion for their wars on Iraq and Afghanistan, bringing spending on the wars to $500 billion. And a Michigan township says that Fox talk show host Bill O'Reilly totally fabricated a story about their town. Weather for today, partly cloudy with temperatures reaching the low 40s, and there's still an air stagnation advisory in effect.
The Marion County Sheriff's Office has won in a union contract negotiation with county officials to keep fully paid health care benefits, an issue that has prolonged labor talks for 6 months. This from the Salem Statesman Journal. County Administrator John Latimer said that although the county will honor the contract, he added that if the county doesn't find a way to control health care costs, he foresees budget problems that could result in layoffs or freezing of open job positions. Members of the Marion County Law Enforcement Association, which is prohibited by state law from striking, had worked without a contract since June. County commissioners are expected to approve the two-year contract today. In negotiations, the county sought to limit the amount it paid for employee health care insurance, forcing employees to pick up the difference between the county's coverage and the actual cost. The union refused to budge. Detective Mike Beach, the union president, said he doesn't agree with the county's argument that it will have to lay off employees if health care benefits aren't cut.
A Lebanese-born Swede had been charged in a plot to set up a terrorist training camp in Oregon, federal prosecutors announced yesterday. A criminal complaint charging Osama Qasr with conspiring to provide material support to terrorists was unsealed in U.S. District Court in Manhattan. The case relates to an indictment in Manhattan already charging Mustafa Kamal Mustafa and Harun Aswat in the plot. Mustafa and Aswat are being detained in England while awaiting extradition to the United States. Qasr was arrested in Prague, Czech Republic on Sunday. He remains detained in Prague as the United States pursues his extradition. The complaint alleges that Qasr and others conspired to establish a training camp for holy war on Bly, Oregon. According to the complaint, Qasr and others wanted to set up the camp to teach military techniques to participants, then to move to Afghanistan to fight or be trained more there. The complaint alleges that in November of 1999, Qasr and another conspirator traveled from London to New York and then on to Seattle and Bly to help with the training camp. Prosecutors said Qasr complained to a witness at Bly that there were only a few men available to train at the camp and that he was not going to waste his time with such a small number of men. Authorities in Oregon have said the camp never materialized beyond a dozen people taking target practice and was abandoned for unknown reasons. Bly is an unincorporated town of a few hundred people, 50 miles east of Klamath Falls.
The cost of rental housing has increased faster than wages, making it increasingly difficult for low-income families to afford even modest apartments. according to the National Low Income Housing Coalition. The coalition, which advocates for more affordable housing, issues a report each year tracking rental costs in every state, county, and metropolitan area in the country. It says families should spend no more than 30% of their incomes on housing and utilities, a standard recognized by many housing experts. Under that standard, the coalition said it could not find a single county in the United States where a full-time worker making minimum wage could afford a one-bedroom apartment. Nationally, families have to make an average of almost $16 an hour to afford a two-bedroom apartment, while spending no more than 30% of their earnings on housing costs. The federal minimum wage of $5.15 an hour was last increased in 1997, and 15 states have minimum wages higher than the federal level. Sheila Crowley, president of the Housing Coalition, said rising housing costs have forced many families to double up, moving multiple families into apartments designed only for one.
The Williams case set off a nationwide debate over the power of redemption. Hollywood stars and anti-death penalty advocates argued that Williams made amends by writing children's books about the dangers of gangs. He was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Some 2,000 people rallied outside the gates of San Quentin during the state's highest-profile execution in a generation. The California Report's Kelly Wilkinson has more.
The crowd was made up of anti-death penalty activists, religious leaders, including the Reverend Jesse Jackson, and young people who said Tookie Williams' life gave them hope. Leading up to the prison gates, a line of small candles flickered in the dark. The overwhelming theme among protesters was redemption and injustice. A man who only gave his name as Malcolm came from Oakland.
It's sad because this system is supposed to be to reform and redeem people, and here it is, we had a redeemed man who we're going to kill anyway.
The crowd was overwhelmingly pro-Williams, but there were two L.A. radio hosts who said they rejoiced in Tookie Williams' execution.
Tookie is not an icon. Tookie is nothing but a murderer.
Williams' supporters pushed close to drown out the dissenters. Closer to midnight, the mood among the demonstrators shifted to grim resignation. The crowd fell silent, and when it became apparent that the execution had been carried out, people struggled with the question of what next. Byron Williams lives in Oakland.
You know, now what? I mean, does it evolve into cynicism, or do the, you know, seeds of hope, you know, sprout up from this? That's going to be everybody's challenge who's out here tonight.
For the California Report, I'm Kelly Wilkinson at San Quentin.
General Motors said yesterday that it plans to nearly triple the number of cars it produces in India to meet growing demand in the South Asian country. The announcement comes just weeks after the company announced it would cut 30,000 jobs and scale back production in the United States. GM previously had announced plans to increase production in India from more than double the 25,000 cars a year it currently produces in the country. Lawrence Burns, Vice President for Research and Development, said that the number of vehicles made in India would eventually reach 80,000. However, Burns provided few details of GM's plans for India. He insisted jobs were not being moved from the United States and said much of the new production would come from increasing the hours of workers already employed by the company, although he did say that some new jobs would be added. GM currently employs about 2,000 people in India. GM said in November that declining sales and rising health care costs would force it to close 12 North American manufacturing facilities by 2008 and cut 30,000 jobs.
New York City is putting more legal pressure on subway and bus workers preparing to strike and bring the nation's largest public transit system to a halt. City officials were expected back in court today, this time to argue a lawsuit against the Transport Workers Union in Brooklyn, seeking damages for expenses already incurred in preparation for a strike. The suit also seeks lost revenues and overtime fines of $25,000 that would double each day for those who walk out on the job. Subway and bus workers voted over the weekend to give the union's board the power to call a strike at 12:01 a.m. Friday when the current contracts run out. Sticking points in negotiations include wages, health benefits, and pensions. Yesterday, a judge granted a preliminary injunction prohibiting the workers from striking if they fail to reach a new contract. State law bans public employee strikes, and workers who walk out risk... Excuse me. State State law bans public employee strikes, and workers who walk out risk losing 2 days' pay for every day of work they miss, or could even be jailed.
The Pentagon is in the early stages of drafting a wartime request for up to $100 billion more for Iraq and Afghanistan. This figure would push spending related to the wars towards a staggering $500 billion. That would be in addition to $50 billion Congress is about to give the Pentagon before lawmakers adjourn for the year, and it only covers operations in Iraq for the beginning of 2006. Since the September 11, 2001 attacks, Congress has approved more than $300 billion for Iraq and Afghanistan. The Pentagon still must write a final proposal, and the White House still has to sign off on the plan. Bush is expected to send it to Congress next year. And that means that the request ultimately could differ from what lawmakers, congressional aides, and military analysts are told the services are seeking. The administration long has contended that it can't put a price tag on future costs because of the unpredictable nature of war. Critics have accused Bush of delaying his war spending request for as long as possible to keep budget deficit projections looking smaller. Such a large funding request, coming during a congressional election year, would present Republicans in the House and Senate with a high-stakes political predicament. On one hand, GOP leaders could choose to sign off on the enormous amount of money and anger fiscally conservative base voters who elected them to rein in government spending, or they could slice the Pentagon's request and leave themselves vulnerable to criticism that they are failing to support troops during wartime.
Terrorism, torture, and modest tax cuts to help rebuild the Gulf Coast dot the agenda for the Republican-controlled Congress. At the end of a year scarred by scandal, GOP leaders are working to salvage as much as possible from a conservative agenda. Democrats are opposing the GOP plan to pare $35 billion or more from the growth of food stamps, health care for the poor, and other federal benefit programs. These cuts may slip until next year. Legislation to open a portion of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for oil drilling faces delay, if not death, at the hands of critics in both parties. An annual spending measure for the Department of Labor and Health and Human Services is expected. Passage of a second spending bill for the Pentagon is complicated by a call by House Republicans for across-the-board cuts to reduce federal budget deficits. Senate proposals as well call for additional spending on hurricane relief and flu pandemic preparation.
A kindler, gentler Pentagon is saying that the military will evaluate peacekeeping to a level comparable to warfighting. For the first time, the Pentagon declared that stability operations are a core U.S. military mission and that they will be given priority comparable to combat operations in training, education, personnel, and other categories. That does not mean that as many troops will be performing peacekeeping sorts of work as are involved in combat, or that the Pentagon budget will be divided equally between warfighting and peacekeeping, nor does it mean the military will create brigades or divisions earmarked specifically for peacekeeping. Rather, it means that more resources will be devoted to training for these stability operations. There also will be more emphasis on developing peacekeeping partnerships with other countries. One of the architects of the new policy, Jeffrey Nadiner, told reporters that many stability operations in the aftermath of major combat would be best performed by indigenous or U.S. civilian professionals. The Bush administration has acknowledged that its pre-war planning for restoring order and public services in Iraq after major combat ended did not work as well as expected.
A Texas prosecutor has issued subpoenas for bank records and other information of a defense contractor involved in the bribery case of a California congressman as part of the investigation of former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. District Attorney Ronnie Earle issued subpoenas for California businessmen Brent Wilkes and Max Gelwicks in connection with a contribution to a fundraising committee at the center of the investigation that led to DeLay's indictment on money laundering charges. Yesterday, Earl subpoenaed written testimony. DeLay and two others gave in a 1994 lawsuit brought by DeLay's former pest control business partner. Ex-partner Robert Blankenship alleged in the suit that he was unjustly cut out of the business by DeLay and other men. The lawsuit ended in a confidential settlement in 1995. DeLay gave differing stories about whether he was an officer of Albo Pest Control Company. During his deposition and when he filed a financial disclosure document with the House, the subpoenas also seek correspondence and internal accounting records. The initial charges have been dismissed, but a judge has let stand the latter charges and DeLay faces possible trial on them. On Monday, Earl asked a judge to halt DeLay's trial while he appeals the dismissal of the conspiracy charge. The judge in the case has said he's likely to move forward with the case while the district attorney appeals, but set a pretrial hearing for December 27th.
Swiss Senator Dick Marty, who's investigating allegations that the CIA kidnapped and illegally shipped terror suspects through European borders, announced that the claims are likely true. In a report issued by a Council of Europe committee, Marty has condemned the U.S. for neither confirming nor denying the claims. Meanwhile, the Polish Prime Minister has commissioned a separate investigation into allegations that the CIA detained suspected terrorists at secret prisons in Poland. Results from that finding are expected as early as next week. FSRN's Danuta Zafranicic reports from Warsaw.
The American ABC television network has recently confirmed earlier allegations that captive terrorists, including the masterminds of the 9/11 attacks in New York, were being held by the CIA in secret prisons on Polish territory. According to ABC, at least a dozen names from among the top captured terrorists have been secretly brought to Poland by the CIA and imprisoned at sites of former Soviet military bases. These allegations were followed by reports in Britain's Sunday Telegraph that the European Union had a deal with the US in which it allowed it to use secret locations in Central Europe as base for CIA interrogations. The allegations were supposedly based on talks between top EU and US officials held 2 years ago in Athens. According to the Sunday Telegraph, important details of this agreement have been removed from the minutes, a claim denied by the spokesman of the European Commission, Frieza Roskam-Ebing.
The conclusion drawn in the article in the Sunday Telegraph is simply completely wrong. It's a pity that they haven't waited for Monday to check with us what the actual facts were. There are no secret minutes of any meeting between the EU and the USA.
According to Human Rights Watch, the main CIA secret prison is based in Poland. Military expert Mark Garlaska told the mass circulation Gazeta Wyborcza daily that at least 24 dangerous Al-Qaeda suspects were held there. The incoming president Aleksander Kwaśniewski, who is due to step down later this month, has also denied that any secret jails were on Polish territory. Prime Minister Marcinkiewicz, in power since October, reiterated that he trusted that. Special Services Coordinator Zbigniew Wasserman says the matter will be investigated, but to date nothing could put the president's statement in doubt.
I have put questions to the heads of the respective intelligence services and special forces units, but we must remember that these matters cannot be discussed in public because of their very nature. However, so far, I must stress that nothing has been confirmed from the allegations made by the media.
American expert Andrew Tickell is with the Stratford Institute, which prepares world economic and political forecasts. Speaking for Polish radio, he stressed that Poland, being one of Washington's leading allies in Europe, could be a suspect.
Both Poland and Romania are two very staunch U.S. allies. When it comes to the war on terror, both countries have sizable contingents operating in Iraq. They've always been very supportive of U.S. initiatives in this area. If it turns out that these facilities, these so-called black sites, are an operation, I would not be surprised.
Meanwhile, Poland's conservative government has drawn fire from the opposition for denying that the prisons existed and has launched an investigation due to growing media pressure. Poland's former defense minister, Bronisław Komorowski, agrees with that view.
Poland should conduct a serious examination in this case, not in the form of a parliamentary investigation, which will treat it as sensational news to be checked, but using all the tools accessible to the government. This should be done in order for Poland to say with a clear conscience to the opposition, either take a unanimous stand and defend the country, or we have checked the facts and nothing in these allegations has proven to be true.
The current controversy over alleged secret detention centers seems to continue, despite pledges by the U.S. that such events never took place in Poland. It will be interesting to see whether Poland comes up with anything substantial after the investigation. The allegations are also being investigated by the Council of Europe. EU Justice and Home Affairs Commissioner Franco Frattini warned that any of the 25 bloc nations found to have operated secret CIA prisons could have their EU voting rights suspended. In Warsaw, I'm Danuta Szafraniec, Free Speech Radio News.
A published report says that federal air marshals will expand their work beyond airplanes, launching counter-terror surveillance at train stations and other mass transit facilities in a test program this week. Teams of undercover air marshals and uniformed law enforcement officers will fan out to bus and train stations, ferries, and mass transit facilities across the country to counter potential criminal terrorist activity in all modes of transportation, according to documents from the Transportation Security Administration, or TSA. The documents showed the teams will take positions in public areas along Amtrak's Northeast Corridor and Los Angeles rail lines, ferries in Washington State, and mass transit systems in Atlanta, Philadelphia, and Baltimore. Teams will patrol the Washington Metro system as well and will consist of two air marshals, one TSA bomb-sniffing canine team, one or two transportation security inspectors, one local law enforcement officer, and one other TSA employee. The Transportation Security Administration is trying to expand the role of air marshal and provide a beefed-up law enforcement presence at bus, train, and other public transit stations over the holiday period. Federal officials say there is no new intelligence indicating that terrorists are interested in targeting transportation modes.
NBC News obtained a secret 400-page Defense Department document that lists an anti-recruitment meeting at a Quaker meeting house in Lake Worth, Florida, as a threat. It was one of more than 1,500 suspicious incidences across the country over a recent 10-month period. The Defense Department document is a first look at how the U.S. military has increased intelligence collection inside the country since 9/11. It includes monitoring of peaceful anti-war and counter-military recruitment groups. The Department of Defense, or DOD, declined repeated requests by NBC News for an interview. A spokesman said that all domestic intelligence information is properly collected. But critics say the Pentagon now collects domestic intelligence that goes beyond legitimate concerns about terrorism or protecting U.S. military installations. The DOD database includes some 4 dozen anti-war meetings and protests. One incident included in the database is a large anti-war protest at Hollywood and Vine in Los Angeles last March. The DOD has strict guidelines adopted in December of 1982 that limit the extent to which they can collect and retain information on U.S. citizens. Documents show that the Defense Department is clearly increasing its domestic monitoring activities. Bert Tussing, Director of Homeland Defense and Security Issues at the U.S. Army War College and a former Marine, says there is very little that could justify the collection of domestic intelligence by the United States military, and if we start going down this slippery slope, it would be too easy to go back to a place we never want to see again.
The U.S. has been ranked sixth with Burma in an annual list of countries that jail journalists, compiled by a New York-based media watchdog. The Committee to Protect Journalists listed China as the worst offender. China jailed 32 journalists last year. Cuba was ranked second for imprisoning 24 reporters in 2005, followed by Eritrea, Ethiopia, and Uzbekistan. Acting against state interests was listed as the commonest allegations behind the imprisonment of reporters. Such accusations, including subversion and revealing state secrets, were linked to the cases of 78 out of the 125 journalists imprisoned around the world, according to the report.
A week after violent police suppression of a demonstration against the construction of a power plant in China that left as many as 20 people dead, most of the Chinese public still knows nothing of the event. This from the International Herald Tribune. It was the largest use of armed force against civilians since the massacre at Tiananmen Square in 1989. Chinese officials used a variety of techniques to keep the story from spreading, from barring most newspapers outside the immediate region of the incident to report on it, to banning place names and other key words associated with the event from major internet search engines such as Google. The government's first response to the news of the violent confrontation between police and protesters in the southern village of Dongzhou has to impose a blanket silence in which Chinese media of all types were apparently banned from reporting the incident. 4 days after the December 6th incident, the official Chinese press agency published the first Chinese media account of the confrontation. Web users who turned to search engines like Google, typing in the word Shanwei, the city with jurisdiction over the village, where the demonstration was put down, would find links to a handful of pages on the city but nothing about the protests. And after a few screens of information unrelated to the incident, the browsers of users who persisted froze. Yesterday, links to foreign news sources appeared after several screens of Google searches, but the links were invariably inoperative.
A group of Chinese activists and academics is calling for an inquiry into the deadly police shooting of villagers protesting the seizure of land for a power plant. But China's leaders have shown unusual concern about the latest violence in southern China as they seek a balance between maintaining order and letting the public vent some frustration. The government says 3 people were killed when police opened fire on villagers. The death toll is likely as high as 20. It was the deadliest clash yet in a series of confrontations between police and villagers angry over land seizures. Public dissent has flourished in recent years as China's communist government eased social controls and complaints over corruption, pollution, and yawning gaps in income grew. By the government's count, China had more than 70,000 cases of unrest last year. The incidents alarmed communist leaders. They are now promising to spend more to raise living standards in the countryside.
Sudan's government says it will not allow international investigators into the troubled province of Darfur to collect evidence on alleged war crimes. The ban comes as a chief prosecutor from the International Criminal Court told the UN Security Council that he wanted more cooperation from Sudan. Luis Moreno Ocampo said he had identified mass killings and rape, but not decided who to prosecute. Some 2 million people have fled their homes in the 3-year Darfur war. Sudan's justice minister says that the ICC had no jurisdiction to try Sudanese nationals. And according to the BBC, only a few low-level military officers have faced charges over the violence in Darfur. Human Rights Watch this week called for senior Sudanese officials, including the president, to be investigated for war crimes against humanity.
Strict security measures have been imposed throughout Iraq on the eve of tomorrow's parliamentary elections. Private and commercial vehicles have been banned from the streets and overnight curfews have been in place. Police in the border town of Basra said that they had seized an oil tanker filled with thousands of forged ballot papers traveling from Iran. The BBC says the reports will cast suspicion on Shia political parties, which have already been criticized for their close relationship with Iran. All of Iraq's parties took advantage of the last day of campaigning on Tuesday to encourage the population to vote. The day was marred, however, by the killing of a prominent Sunni Arab politician. Iraqi Free Progressive Party leader Misar Dulahimi was shot dead in western Iraq. 4 U.S. soldiers were also killed by a roadside bomb in northwest Baghdad. Despite the deaths, there seems to be much less violence in the run-up to the poll in comparison with January.
Local officials at a Michigan township say that Bill O'Reilly made up his story about their town. O'Reilly claimed that the Saginaw Township officials banned residents from wearing red and green during the holiday season. This from TV5. Fox talk show host Bill O'Reilly said on his radio show, "In Saginaw, Michigan, the township opposes red and green clothing on anyone. In Saginaw Township, they basically said, 'Anybody, we don't want you wearing red or green. I would dress up from head to toe in red and green if I were in Saginaw, Michigan.'" Saginaw Township Supervisor Tim Braun, who says O'Reilly's comments are flat-out not true. Braun goes on to say that the township hall has red and green Christmas lights adorning the building at night. On December 12th, the Fox News Channel, which broadcasts O'Reilly's cable TV show, The O'Reilly Factor, told TV5 it was a radio issue and had nothing to do with the Fox News Channel. And that's the KABU Morning News for Wednesday, December 14, 2005. Weather for today calls for partly cloudy with temperatures in the low 40s, and the air stagnation advisory is still in effect. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, and Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kabu.fm. Our producer for this morning's newscast is Brian Smith. Our assistant producer is Chris Andre. Our engineer is Greg. And the KABU Morning News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Brian Smith.
Chavez.
And that's coming up later on KABU at 7:30. Eduardo de Landeros Tierra, guest host on Talk Radio. He and his guests will discuss the Palestinian wall and the wall at the U.S.-Mexican border and the connection between the two. At 9, it's Movie Talk with Ed, DK, and Don. At 9:30, Parafagrin speaks with former KABU host and reporter Paul Roland, who now lives in Italy. He'll discuss a popular revolt near his home in northern Italy over a massive high-speed train construction project. At 10, on People Rise Up, Andrew Galler examines the active proposals to site liquefied natural gas facilities along the Oregon coast. And 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. And that's all right here on KABU, your community-sponsored, non-corporate, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored radio station. And be sure to catch the KABU Evening News at 5 p.m. Thanks for joining us.
This is the KABU Community Calendar for Wednesday, December 14th. On December 14th, Portland actors will take to the streets of downtown Portland in the area surrounding Pioneer Courthouse Square. At noon, at their respective street corners, the actors will recite Hamlet's speech to the players and then a monologue of their choice. The kickoff event is a way to bring attention to Portland Area Theaters Alliance's Portland Playdate. This campaign is to encourage people to play local by attending local theater the last Friday of each month. Participating companies are offering 2-for-1 tickets on the Playdate Friday. Companies participating include Portland Center Stage, the Artist Repertory Theater, Coho Theater, Stark Raving Theater, Miracle Theater, Profile Theater, Integrity Productions, Stumptown Stages, Theater Vertigo, Lakewood Theater, Two Boars, Northwest Children's Theater, and many more. The playdate falls on December 30th this month. For more info, call 503-413-9825. Vancouver for Peace is holding their film night on December 14th at 7 p.m. The film that is being shown is titled Profits for Punishment, which is about states contracting out the management and liability of prisoners to private multinational companies. Admission is free, and the film will be shown at Marshall Elementary School, located at 6400 MacArthur Boulevard in Vancouver, Washington. The doors open at 6:45 and the film starts at 7. There will be a discussion following. For more info, call 360-696-4840. The Pride Foundation in Seattle has announced their Spring 2006 granting cycle. Applications can be downloaded from their website at www.pridefoundation.org, and downloading the application helps them save paper and postage, leaving more funds available for future grants and scholarships. If you are unable to download an application, please call Jeffrey at 800-735-7287. The application deadline is January 20th, 2006. The Pride Foundation makes grants in support of education, advocacy, and outreach, lesbian health, health and community services, youth and family services, HIV and AIDS service education and support, as well as arts and recreation. The Community Calendar has a new email address. Please send all press releases or event listings to kabucommunitycalendar@gmail.com, or you can still bring it down to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue and drop it off. Or if you feel like faxing it in, send it to 503-231-7145. Thank you for listening to the KABU Community Calendar for Wednesday, December 14th. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM in the Gorge, and 100.7 FM in the Willamette Valley.